Hey everybody, wherever you are all over the world, we're going to cover the April 17th Digital Bytes. Over here, Team Blockchain on the podcast. Johnny Fry, right here next to me. How you doing?
Hello, hello. Good to be back on the air with you, James. All well. Can't believe 17th of April. Where's the year going to?
That really is that. We just did our taxes here in the United States. And
oh my goodness.
Yeah, it was up pretty late.
Well, our tax year is the 5th of April. So we have to get all our tax stuff in before that. But it's always a bit of a scrabble.
Yeah, ours was yesterday. And, you know, It's funny. For years, I've used this company for the crypto taxes. And they're gone. Yeah. You can't even keep the tax companies alive in the cryptocurrency world. This is the first year I did it by hand. And I hate everybody.
You're the techie geek. You might be doing it digitally.
I was using Excel with summaries and formulas and copying and pasting. I even found a bug in Apple's Numbers app. That really got me out. Really. Never again. Never again.
Never again. Never again. Oh, dear. Okay, so this week we've got another selection of stories. I really enjoyed the first one. It's what can we learn from the biggest fund manager, the biggest asset manager in the world? And we did a quick review of Larry Fink's 2024 letter to investors. And so we'll cover that as he talks about sort of, you know, the world and the importance of savings. And then this whole, you know, what are BlackRock doing as the world's biggest fund manager? What are they doing around tokenization and digitization? It's all very well to talk about these things, but what are they actually doing? So we'll look at that. USDE. Now, this has come out of nowhere. And this company raised about $16 million. They're worth $300 million. They've managed to attract $2.2 billion as a stable coin. But it's a stable coin that is using delta hedging. This is more back to your old Wall Street days, James. They're using algorithms and futures and selling volatility and managing to get a yield of about 27%. So no surprise they've attracted a lot of attention. And then last week we touched on Solana, and it's obviously performed very well. And it had a meme coin called Bonk, B-O-N-K, which is up over 4,000%. So we've turned our attentions this week to look a little bit at meme coins. A dreadful name for a site, pump.fun. That clearly states what it's going to do on the tin, doesn't it? You know, pump and dump and have some fun, but there you go. And then coming up after the break, delighted to be joined by William Lawrence from the Digital Pound Foundation. And William is going to be talking about harnessing the digital pound to enhance sustainability in the UK. So William's coming up after the break, James.
Yeah, I probably have a lot to say about meme coins and a couple of ideas about USDE. I might be a Debbie Downer, I don't know, but you see if you can turn me around.
Well, okay, look, first of all, I want to just touch back on Larry Fink, because as you know, I've been in the fund management industry since the early 90s. And I kind of think, you know, if you're going to, you know, it always makes sense to listen to people being hugely successful. And Larry Fink started BlackRock. And since he floated the company, the share price up 9,000%, grown it into the biggest asset management company in the world, got over $10 trillion of money under management. And he's been banging the drum. He was pretty negative about Bitcoin a few years back, which I think is a good thing, because he's then gone from being very negative to being very positive about the technology behind Bitcoin and talking about the next generation for markets, the next generation for securities is going to be tokenization of securities. And he's gone on live, you know, several times, both you know, on things like Twitter, but also being interviewed on Bloomberg Money and things like that. And we have an expression in the UK saying actions speak louder than words. So what has he actually been doing about it? Well, BlackRock went out and created an ETF, a Bitcoin ETF, which regular listeners will be very familiar with. And that's become the fastest growing ETF of all time. It's got over $10 trillion worth of assets. And he's then actually said, well, you know, not only do we want to have an ETF, but we want to put Bitcoin into our US institutional digital liquidity fund. Bit of a mouthful, but James, this is basically a fairly low risk, almost like international bond fund. So you kind of think, well, why on earth would you put, you know, a very volatile asset in a very involatile, very safe, very secure asset strategy? And so that led us to look at something I know you're familiar with, and a lot of institutional investors will, but for perhaps retail investors, There's something called a Sharpe ratio. And what a Sharpe ratio does, it looks at how much are you expecting to get, or what have you actually earned on your portfolio? Take away risk-free, so I don't know, take away, you know, treasury yields or treasury returns, and then divide it by the standard deviation of the portfolio you're looking at. And what this means is that you're basically saying, well, how much have you grown above risk-free, i.e. leaving it in the bank, let's say, and then divide that by the volatility, the zig and the zag. So have you been compensated for the volatility? Because if you've got something which is going massively up and massively down, and on a risk-adjusted basis, it doesn't do as well as something which just plods along, a bit like the mad hare and the tortoise race we were taught as in, you know, as children. And if you look at the S&P 500, the long-term Sharpe ratio of that is a number of 0.62, which in itself doesn't mean anything. You have to compare it to other assets. So if you look at Bitcoin Sharpe ratio is 3.44. So it's got a much better risk-adjusted return. And it's basically saying over the longer term, Bitcoin has been more than worth having some exposure, because although it's been really, really volatile, it's actually grown a lot. So that's why I think we're seeing BlackRock saying we want this very volatile thing, Bitcoin, in a very low risk strategy. We just want to put a little bit because we think it will enhance the overall return for investors. So I think that's a pretty good example of how the biggest asset manager in the world has been adopting, you know, not only launching a Bitcoin ETF, but also using that as an asset class. And then they've gone on from that, James, and they've launched a tokenized money market fund. And again, and this is a topic regular listeners will be familiar with. And this is where asset managers are tokenizing, digitizing their money market funds, which means they now become a serious competitor to bank deposit funds, or as you call them, savings funds. So instead of actually putting money in a money market fund, it takes maybe 2 or 3 days to get your money out. You'll be able to get your money out the same day. So you could actually put your money in a money market fund as an alternative to having it in a bank. And we've seen in the US about $5 trillion coming out of the banks and finding its way into CDs, certificates of deposits, and money market funds. And I think as we see tokenized money market funds, we'll see a lot more money coming out. And the banks will start saying, well, hang on, we're going to have to put up our interest rates and pay a better rate of return, which hits their profits, in order to stop this stem of money, because it's much safer having your money spread across a whole range of different instruments professionally managed in money market fund, rather than just leaving it with one bank as a bank deposit.
Yeah, I don't know if these banks are ready to accept certain things. They don't even want to talk about tokenization. Certain banks, right? It's very extreme odds.
No, you're absolutely right. Although I've just come back from an event where head of sort of finance for McKinsey was talking, and he was saying basically talking to the banks in all sorts of different jurisdictions, you know, particularly in Asia, a little bit in Europe, not so much in America. You know, banks are realizing they've got to become more digitally native, and they've got to embrace digitalization, got to embrace things like Internet of Things and blockchain, because, you know, their customers are demanding it. And you're seeing, they quoted over, just in Europe, there's 80 million customers now using the neobanks. So they're taking a big chunk of business away from traditional banks. So they're going to have to respond by looking at ways that they can attract, or certainly keep existing customers, and try and attract some of those customers who've gone to these small fintech, neobank, startup bank, challenger banks, whatever you want to call them, because they begin to take quite a dent, certainly here in Europe.
All right. I want to talk about this this new stable coin, because it caught me off guard just this week. I was, you know, that situation where somebody says something and you go, I have no idea what you're talking about. That's what happened to me in this one.
Yeah, but James, that's what, you know, look, you and I have been doing this. This is our fifth season. I've been doing research on this whole topic now for, you know, about 8 years. And you're absolutely right. You know, USDE from Athena Labs. It's the unitary status dollar e-coin. What a mouthful. And it's the fifth largest stable coin already. And it's basically trying to give you a return equivalent to the US dollar with a high yield. So it's meant to be tracking the dollar, but it's trying to give you a high yield, a high interest rate. And the interest rate, you know, they're up to 27%. Well, why wouldn't you be attracted? And of course, what's happened? They've sucked in an incredible $2.2 billion already. And the way they're doing it is they talk about delta hedging. with, you know, and basically using sort of options and derivatives to actually give a higher yield on the actual US dollar. And it's great all the time it works. But as you know, with, and you know this better than I do, once you get involved in the derivatives market, these things can suddenly go horrendously wrong, you know, when, you know, the markets move against you. But at the moment, they're actually taking advantage of volatility and effectively selling volatility to create a very attractive yield for this USDE.
Here's a, listen, right out of the gate, I feel like we've seen this movie before, and and I've read the book. Now, if it's going to work, I mean, that's great. I'm not going to deny progress. Give it a shot. Do what you got to do. But isn't this idea about having a, they're going to call it a stable coin, right? I'm assuming it's a stable coin based on this,
well, this
algorithm.
Is the problem.
I'm sorry?
This is the problem. But this is the problem, James. You know, right. this is, you know my thoughts on stable coins. It's a horrible expression. At best, what they're trying to, the investment objective of this, and it's a bit like a collective investment scheme, you could argue. The investment objective is to track the US dollar and create a high yield. The strategy, it's more like a hedge fund. You know, they're using all sorts of fancy derivatives. And you know, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but anyone going and putting their money and thinking, well, I'm basically, this is an alternative to putting money in the US dollar in a, you know, in a deposit account. Well, it's nothing like it because the risks they're taking, that's why you're potentially earning, you know, they talk about 27%. Well, you know, it sounds too good to be true. You're right. What's the catch? Well, the catch is it's the way in which they're looking after your money is more like a hedge fund in the sense that what they're doing is they're going into the derivatives market. And they're creating this sexy yield, but it comes at a potential price. And that potential price is if it goes the wrong way, you could suddenly find it gets de-pegged and you could lose 5, 10, 15, 20%. I don't know what. So the fact that calling a stable coin, I think, is a little bit disingenuous because I know you're trying to keep it pegged to the dollar. But the reality is that your exposure is to much, much riskier assets.
Yeah, so I feel like a five-year-old could keep something in sync. But it's going to take a real team of geniuses to control something that's volatile. But, I mean, it's the opposite. Stable is the opposite of volatile.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as I say, you know, it's...
We'll
there's
see.
A lot of similarities between this and I thought you were going to talk about Terra Luna. Which
I didn't want to call them... Yes, that's what I meant. I wasn't going to be that guy.
And there are all sorts of hassles with that. But look, I personally don't have a problem with USDE, provided the people that go into it understand what they're buying. And the objective, as I say, is to track the US dollar with a high yield. Very commendable. The strategy is you are exposing yourself to the vagaries of the futures market, you know, staking and using futures with cryptocurrencies. So if you're comfortable with that, not a problem. But don't go into this coin if you think it's as safe as having a US dollar proxy, you know, and it's going to perform in line with the US dollar, because you could be, you're really, really pleasantly surprised, or you could be very, very disappointed because the exposure you've got is not holding US, you know, short dated treasury, putting the money in a bank. There's a big chunk of the money exposed to the vagaries of the crypto market.
And you said they got private funding, right? This wasn't like a private sale, like an ICO or anything?
No, they managed to get private funding. First it did $6 million, then another $14 million. But the business is now valued over $30 million. And no surprise, you know, they're obviously taking a fee. Couldn't actually, I'm not sure what fee they're taking off of that $2.2 billion, but $2.2 billion is not a bad bet for a business less than a year, I think less than a year old.
Yeah, I think we'll probably have some other articles about this, maybe. I'll keep an open mind.
So now we move on to these meme coins. Now, James, can you help me out? I've heard of Dogecoin. I've heard of Shibu Inu. We talked about Bonk last year, the coin, not the Kama Sutra. What are meme coins then?
So, I used to say that it was just... I'm the type of guy that applies a use case to everything. And I remember years ago, Dogecoin was do only good every day. And it was philanthropy, right? The purpose of Doge was to give it to other people and share it and do good. And that's still their MO. But more recently, it's more about the price. like everything, like every other coin. But it paved the way for meme coins that now meme coins became, they do nothing. And I recently had a conversation with people, had to do with Bonk and Pepe, right? Remember Pepe?
Pepe the Frog.
The Frog. And
having a Pepe or Pee-Pee.
There was issues, right, around Pepe, because Pepe was a piece of art created by an artist who, in theory, owned the intellectual property. So, and that was the first time that meme coins that do nothing and are owned by no one to do anything actually had some intellectual property rights. It was a little scary. So we watched meme, the culture, change into what is essentially now, today, I would call a boys and girls club. I was told that people love these meme coins because they can't. If you don't expect too much from me, you will never be let down. It's gambling. But it's gambling with the confidence that it's. They acknowledge it's my own fault. And these coins run. I mean, they go bonk 4,000%,
they sure
right?
Do. Yeah.
The theory behind it is, what's the worst that could happen? Going to go to
you
zero? Or am I going to be a millionaire? And it's so they've got cope, they got FOMO, you got all your emotions, and it's becoming now fun. There's almost unwritten rules. They're like, we're not even going to get rug pulled because we want them to immediately just give. We don't want to know who the dev is. We just want you to launch it, get it rolling, and walk away. Let us have, it's a community coin. And meme took on a good word. I think I said this in the past. I never thought I'd be alive to turn on Bloomberg and see a meme category, a GameStop, yeah. An AMC.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
what GameStop did. This moved into the stock market. GameStop yeah. had, you know, no fundamentals, a little business. AMC, nobody even goes to the movies anymore. But the community said, let's blow somebody's mind and pump these stocks and, you know, damn the man, screw the rich, squeeze them. All of a sudden, your next door neighbor knew what a naked short was. They argued whether or not they're legal. And they're applying all this to the coins in the unregulated DeFi crypto world. And it's a game. It's a game with the big part of, you're not going to let me down. Now, with that said, Solana has been running a whole meme thing lately. That's the hot new, I think you brought up Pump Fun and all that.
Yeah, not 19,000 memes on Solana Network to run.
I caught the CEO of Solana on Twitter saying, this is not what we created Solana for, guy. What are you doing? Like, he doesn't want Solana to be known as the joke around chain. Lord knows their uptime is a joke and their stability is a joke. And I don't mind saying that. It's literally on a technical aspect. It could use a lot of improvement. I will say that.
But wow, it's performed well over the last year again, James.
Sure, and that probably because of memes.
Yeah.
Right? It's memes keeping them alive. And the Solana network itself is like, hey, we can't have this tattoo. But that goes to show you the strength of the meme culture. Because they're like, shut up, Solana. We're going to use you, whether you like it or not. There's nothing you can do about it. And right now, as we speak, Solana is the network for it.
Yeah. Well, James, I'm mindful. I don't want to steal your thunder because I know you've been working on an article in the next couple of weeks looking at this. Maybe we end up having two types of markets. We have the regulated markets that we know, love and trust, or in theory, we trust in them, because typically if something goes wrong, then there's some form of compensation. Someone gets fined. And then there's the whole unregulated markets. And the grey market, the shadow economy, you could almost talk. And the reason I mention that at the moment is that here we are, we're recording this on the 16th of April. It's a Tuesday. So it's the day before this particular edition is sent out in printed format or certainly email format. But a couple of days ago, we had a horse race called the Grand National. And the horse race, it goes over the jumps. And it's a big race. It lasts about 9 minutes, and a lot of controversy because in the past, unfortunately, some of the horses have been killed. But it's probably the premier over the jumps race, I'd argue, probably in the world. And there's thousands of people once a year
And many, many offices and buildings and workplaces in the UK, they have one bet, and they have sweepstakes, and people put in a fiver or a ten or whatever it may well be. But they have one bet a year for some reason on the Grand National, 30-odd horses, and the odds go from anywhere like 10 to 1 to like 500 to 1. And you have a similar thing, the Melbourne Cup in Australia. And you have a similar thing, the Kentucky Derby. And my point is that every day on TV and on the internet, we're bombarded with, why don't you have a bet on this? Why don't you have a bet on that? And there's many people who don't agree with betting, but there's huge economies and massive amount of worth. And again, US is the extreme. Some states it's banned gambling. Other states, you know, it generates a huge amount of income. And at its sort of, you know, at its zenith is probably Las Vegas, a whole city devoted to gambling. And you kind of think, well, if people want to gamble, in the old days they would gamble on the pink sheets, i.e. these stocks that were could have been gold in the hills in Canada, or you know, and they were basically listed on the big board. And in Wall Street, as I say, you had the pink sheets, and you had little penny share people tipping shares. They'll go up, they'll go down, the sideways. Then we had cryptocurrencies, and along came ICOs. Then along came, after ICOs, we had NFTs, and now we've got meme coins. The thing is, if someone wants to gamble, it's their money. That's fair enough. But they need to understand that they are not going to be protected by the same rules and regulations as if you were trading, you know, Tesla stock or Microsoft, or buying an authorized fund or an ETF or something like that. And there seems to be almost a desire for those that want to have a punt on the horses or go to Vegas on the tables, or you could argue you want to go into the metaverse, the ethereal world, and buy something like a meme coin, because they just do. It has no value. But then playing blackjack has no value. But it's their way of engaging with the community and thinking that they can outsmart the community and buy low and sell high. And as you say, that site, pump.fun, it kind of explains it all, doesn't it? Having a bit of fun, but you could get involved in something that's pumped up to nothing and pop, you know, the air goes out of it and the coin goes from, you know, $10 to zero overnight. So, you know, as ever, buyer beware, but maybe we do need to have space for the regulated market and unregulated things like, I'm going to speculate on garden furniture or tulips in Amsterdam. Look at the tulip bulb mania that we had. So this isn't something new. This desire for individuals to want to gamble has been around for, you know, since man's been walking around. But I know you've got an article coming, so I'm looking forward to your thoughts on this over the next couple of weeks, James.
Yeah, and I am all for the world starting to acknowledge that it's their responsibility. It's on them. If that actually happens 10, 20, 30 years, hey, that's better, right? Maybe less regulation, less lawsuits, the whole nine. It's my fault. I did it. It's all right.
The only thing is, James, unfortunately, here in the UK, it's going the opposite way. The financial regulations, we used to sort of have a doctrine, or used to have an expression, caveat emptor, you know, buyer beware. James, you're about to buy an investment product. Are you aware of what you're actually doing? You have a degree of responsibility. You're going to, you know, you're going to set, transfer that money, sign the check, fill out the application, make sure you know what you're doing. But the regulators sort of come back on that a little bit here in the UK. And we have a new set of regulations which really come and bite by the 31st of July this year, and it's called Consumer Duty. And the regulators say, well, some of these products are so complex, it's not good enough for the seller of these financial products to be able to say, well, it was up to the buyer. They should have known. Caveat emptor. And they're saying, no, that's not good enough. You know, you owe a duty of care to your investors to make sure, A, they understand what they've bought and why they've bought it and what are the reasonable expectations. And then on a regular basis, are you making sure that the clients are aware of how it's performing, what have they got and what are they bought? So we've moved away from caveat emptor into, you know, looking at this whole area of consumer duty. And I understand there's discussions are coming into Europe, and I wouldn't be at all surprised, especially given the litigious nature of the USA, that we'll see something similar in the States not too long.
Hey, Florida recently legalized gambling, by the way. That was a recent move.
Wow. Well, because there's loads of money in it, James. You think of the huge casinos they'll be building down in Miami to attract all those people, those holidaymakers, the land of the eternal sun. But there you go. Well, look, James, we better scoot along because I know we've got William coming up and he's going to be talking about harnessing a digital pound. And just before we go, if you would like a copy of Digital Bytes, then just contact James Tiley at cyber.fm or myself, Johnny Fry at Team Blockchain. And then every week it goes out to about 20,000 people looking at who, how, where, and why blockchain and digital assets are being used. And then we bring along a guest to give some examples and practical insights as to why they like it or why they hate it. There's no investment advice. We're just simply trying to be a little bit thought-provoking, a little bit educational about this topic, because there's so many people sort of, you know, either they're very, very against it because they don't understand it typically, or they're just trying to punt and the next meme coin or the next this, the next that. That's not what we're here for. We're trying to look at the commercial opportunities around the technology and the assets, which I hope you enjoy listening to us here on cyber.fm going out to, wow, 4.6 million listeners, James. That's pretty impressive, the reach you've got globally around the world.
Teamblockchain.net, right in front of you the minute it loads up. We don't care how you listen to this show. I'd love for you to listen on cyber.fm, but let's be realistic. Anchor, Spotify, Apple, Google, Amazon, iHeart, CastBox, Stitcher, TuneIn, Pandora, and you could always say, Alexa, open up Digital Bytes Podcast. We put that right there in the very front, and right next to it, if you have no idea what we're talking about every week, stick your email address in there and actually get the newsletter.
Well, welcome back, and I'm delighted to be joined today by William Lawrence from the Digital Pound Foundation. And William, you've written an article talking about harnessing a digital pound to enhance sustainability in the UK. But before we get stuck into the article, it'd be great just to have a bit of background about yourself and some of the work that the Digital Pound Foundation is doing, if that's okay.
Yeah, hello, everyone. So my background is 20-something years in fintech before that was even a word. Twice founder, and more recently a stint at a kind of fiat banking as a service provider that then for the last couple of years has evolved into a more broad brush portfolio career, which stays in the fiat world, helping early stage fintechs find the right payment partners and stretches through to the DeFi world, in particular with the fact that I lead the Digital Pound Foundation's use case working group, where we are trying to find a practical use for a retail digital pound for the UK citizen on the street, which is proving easier said than done, but we'll talk about that. And then the Digital Pound Foundation itself is a roughly two-year-old trade association that, as the name suggests, explores in the broadest context possible digital pound and what it could mean for UK PLC and how to exploit it, get it started in all shapes and regards. So we have work streams across policy, working with the various authorities and responding to consultations, working with them directly. There's an identity and privacy working group, because if you don't have a digital identity, can you ever really get the pound itself working? And then there's my place in the use case, kind of practical application thereof. And one more thing to add there is we are agnostic officially to whether a digital pound is incarnated as a private stable coin or a obviously government CBDC, central bank digital currency.
Got it.
And there are nuances around that, perhaps for another day.
Okay. All right. So in your article, you cited the World Economic Forum and talking about this sort of transition, the circular sort of paradigm, and it could, you know, potentially create, you know, 8 million jobs by 2030. And talking about, you know, the circular economy could unlock 4.5 trillion, that's a huge number, William.
Yes, well, a lot of the kind of thesis we have is about the kind of value locked up in existing payment systems and methodologies and so on. And fundamentally, if you can both incentivize people for behavior, which is a big part of this article, but also kind of increase the velocity of money, that should all wash through to those benefits that the WEF is talking about.
Got it. Got it. Okay, so a couple of examples that you've come up with in terms of how a digital pound could help sustainability. You're talking about recycling and sort of, so is this a bit like the old sort of, used to have bottles of pop when mum and dad went down the pub and then you'd collect all the bottles up and then you'd get something back for it? Is it a similar version to that?
Well, that's one of the more basic examples. Yes, you know, the 5p or 10p on a glass bottle or a can, which obviously exists in other countries, incidentally, and I've always been slightly surprised the UK hasn't come back to that. But there is the bottle deposit scheme in regulation, which I believe is getting going in Scotland, but has been repeatedly delayed back here down in England. And a lot of that's around, you know, the mechanics of giving the rewards back. How do you collect that, you know, let's say 5 pence per item, collect it, collate it, and ultimately ship it back to the person doing the recycling to drive the incentive? And that whole kind of micropayment, instant payment sector, you can solve some of it with existing payment methodologies, but probably the economics of it make more sense if you have a new instrument such as a digital pound. And that's interestingly, that's one of the touchy areas that we always revolve around in the use case working group is, you know, why would a digital pound be better than the existing, you know, fully banked, often instant payment rails we have, particularly in the UK today? It's a hard question, but there are kind of nuances and edges around that particular example.
Okay, so where else are you seeing then digital pound could be used? You've given some various examples, like clothes, sort of sharing rental platforms, paper. What are some of the things that stand out for you then?
Well, yeah, I think you've got that kind of micropayment end, a bit like you've described, you know, sharing, rental, those kinds of areas, pay as you bin, general recycling rewards. And if you want to drive that, you end up with a much more nuanced ecosystem of, you know, smart bin sensors, micropayments, all the data that's got to move around that and be logically tied together. And then I suppose at the broader sense, you can get to, you know, rent by the hour shared vehicle usage, which often the value there, as is often the case more broadly in the use case work, is not just in the payment, but the fact you've got to tie it into other elements like renting a car by the hour. You've got insurance elements, who's got it at a given moment in time, all those other bits and bobs that go around the transaction. So it's often the value in the smart contract as much as the actual payment rails differentiation that really, really swings it. And if you apply that more broadly to the four or five themes that we've been exploring beyond the one in this particular article, often, it has to be said, 70% plus of the value is around, you know, programmability, a bit of a love it or hate it word in this environment. But the programmability and the smart contract, not just the actual payment step.
Right. So it's managing to automate payments, reducing the sort of friction of dealing with various different intermediaries. And also, I suppose, linking it to sort of, as you say, things like IoT sensors, AI, all that sort of stuff. So having it's not just making the payment, but also having more control and more transparency, because then people can then see what's happened, when, who, and why. And I suppose it's embedding a lot of data. You know, a lot of people talk about ISO 22, and that's the real thing in terms of having more data in that transaction rather than just the transaction.
Well, I mean, if you step back to the kind of the purest fintech payment hat I have, yes, all the differentiation and competitive advantages becoming around the data that goes with a transaction, not the transaction itself, you know, perhaps slightly stating the obvious, but we're already going in that direction on existing rails, like, as you said, ISO on various fiat payment methodologies and rails, faster payments coming soon, SWIFT, etc. And that goes up a notch of complexity and extra data value add if you get the whole smart contract tied into a digital pound payment, basically.
Okay. I know the Digital Pound Foundation works with other entities, other organizations in the States and in Europe. But
yeah.
How far are they advanced, or would you say any one jurisdiction is ahead of the other?
Yeah. So the effectively the kind of sister trade associations we have, just to spell it out, are the DEA, the Digital Euro Association. I went to one of their conferences in Frankfurt earlier this year, and the Digital Dollar Project. I think the sense of relative maturity around, you know, digital pound, euro, or dollar, it's interesting because probably the most mature is Europe with the ECB, because they've already got to the stage. By the way, go back to, it could be a stable coin, it could be a central bank digital currency. But if we stick with the latter, the ECB is really, you know, they put out that billion euro tender for people to actually build proof of concepts and so on. They're off and running and they've got to that stage. And then if you stay at the purely technical kind of development level, Bank of England, UK is getting there. US Fed, it's a huge political hot potato. They are actually thinking about it under the scenes, but nothing much is going to go public till the election there, which will swing progress either to get moving if it's Biden or grind to a halt if it isn't. they're probably last. But in my use case world, I have to say, I think the common theme of everyone is struggling to really, particularly in retail, actually, not so much wholesale, which is slightly outside my remit, but in the retail space, they're really struggling to nail a practical use case of true value to the citizen. And this came up, saw this all over, you know, the European conference I was at, you know, somebody from the ECB saying, this is a little political project looking for a solution. And we've had similar comments, as everyone knows, from the House of Lords way back in the UK. But then on the flip side, you know, you dig and you find details, you find nuances, and it's classic kind of early adopter technology. Every technology cycle, the internet back in late 90s, people were wondering what the hell it was for. So we're at a similar stage and cycle, and it will be, you know, 3 years till something really gets proven in Europe, 4 or 5 in the UK, and similar-ish depending on the politics in the US.
So you think this is in terms of then a true adoption of digital currencies for payments and transactions, is what, 3 to 5 year out? That's what we're looking at. Is that for CBDCs, or do you think that's also the case for more commercial use cases and payments?
Stablecoin-y stuff. I think that is a CBDC specific comment. You're right. I mean, stablecoins, there's a couple of use cases, cross border being the blatantly obvious one, that are often running, and you know, this is for delivery cross, sped up delivery cross border. They're often running and are taken as read. But that fundamental value question still playing out. Pretty confident it will get there, but then you've got the kind of political hot potato issues are obviously around programmable or purpose-bound money and no to CBDC protests and all of this, which again is what you get with every new technology. And usually we go through that and value is found.
Yeah. You always get the naysayers and say, we don't need it. What we've got is absolutely fine. And then when they start realizing they can actually do things faster and cheaper and greater transparency, then...
Well, you know what it was? It's the privacy and government control bit, which is obviously the hot topic. I mean, to give you a sense of how hot, the Bank of England's recent consultation had 50,000 responses, of which I'm slightly estimating here 49,500 were individuals going, we don't want this because the government might control us, you know, click automatic. So you've got that hype. But it's interesting, we've been doing in the use case working group some work, thanks to a guy called Andrew Buckley and University of Manchester, has been doing some research on, you know, early-ish adopter Gen Z reactions to a theoretical central bank digital currency. And they are a lot less uptight on this whole privacy and control and government visibility of spend patterns. And, you know, why shouldn't we conceptually have some limits on, I don't know, sin items we buy, like those that cause a lot of CO2, meat or fuel or something like that. So it may be generational, but there are some signs that, yeah, it's not one-sided, at least. And that's part of the work of this use case working group.
Okay, now it was interesting because you were talking about that Manchester Business School. That was some fairly sort of a fairly small group, but they're looking to actually now have a much bigger cohort of people to test some of these hypotheses, I understand.
Yeah, that's gone from qualitative research with about 120 students, which was a great start. Nobody's ever done anything like that. University of Manchester, incidentally, just to be precise. And yeah, they're looking, Andrew and team out of Manchester are looking to extend it to a quantitative survey. You know, early signs I saw about to be released, and I've seen an updated draft paper. Sorry, let me retake that. That was stumbling. It's about to be released, and I've seen their latest draft, which absolutely talks about if there's utility in it, people might use it, particularly if there's an incentive to use it. This is Andrew's thesis of government policy push. You know, a small discount for buying government services, or maybe that could spin all the way through to it's fundamentally slightly cheaper than existing payment rails. So if you use it for standard old e-com point of sale checkout, you get a discount or extra loyalty points that effectively are a discount. So there are areas to explore around that, and quite what will swing it, yeah, is still to be thrashed out.
Brilliant. And if people want to get more information about Digital Pound Foundation or yourself, what's the best way? Is LinkedIn probably just as good as anywhere?
Well, yeah, personally, LinkedIn's the way to go. You know, everything's there, all the different things I do, Digital Pound Foundation included. But come find me, but also digitalpoundfoundation.com is our primary website. Have a dig around there. You know, there are ways to get hold of our membership secretary, Michelle, and there's a kind of rundown of the use case and other working group remits, so you can see the kind of areas we're working in go well beyond what we've had time to discuss today.
Okay, and presumably over the next few months, the Digital Pound Foundation will be putting out more papers. You've mentioned the study from Manchester University. There'll be other working parties and the information you'll be publishing to keep people up to date with the pros and cons of a digital pound.
Well, yeah, not just on the area we've discussed today, absolutely, but more broadly. So again, there's a news feed on the website I just mentioned, and of course, LinkedIn, that's probably your key place. If you go and follow Digital Pound Foundation, you'll get, you know, weekly updates across the board. So it's quite a good place to, you know, get generalist update. Whilst we are a group of experts, we're very conscious that we're trying to talk both at that level and in a more generally accessible manner.
Fantastic. Well, look, William, thank you very much for sharing. And as William said, if you'd like to get a copy of his article, then either contact myself, Johnny Fry, JONNYFRY on LinkedIn, or William Lawrence. And that's William and then LORENZ. And we'll get a copy of the article to you. But thank you for listening. And William, thank you for coming on. And we'll try and get you back later in the year, because I know you're doing a lot of work behind the scenes, and it'd be interesting to share some of that analysis and work out as it develops and evolves over the next few months.
Yeah, this will absolutely move on and be interesting and great to keep in touch. So thanks, everybody. Come find me or us at digitalpoundfoundation.com.